All right. So our special guest today is Lori Rosenthal, Director of Operations for the Grand Junction Housing Authority. Lori has worked for the authority for over 10 years. Well, for 10 years. She started her career with the Grand Junction Housing Authority as a housing specialist and is now the Director of Operations. For those of you who may not be aware, the Grand Junction Housing Authority is the grantee for this TCCI grant application. So, Lori, thank you for being on the call, and thank you for your patience. And let's get started, and tell us a little bit about yourself and what it's like to run a housing authority.
Well, I have been here at the Housing Authority. This is my 11th year. I did start out as a housing specialist, just processing eligibility and that kind of thing for the voucher program. And then I became the supervisor of the voucher program. Most of my knowledge was centered around vouchers. And then about a year later, I became the director of operations. And what that means is I oversee all of our housing programs and all of our supportive services programs. So I am responsible for tax credit, knowing tax credit rules, knowing multifamily Section 8 rules, and also Section 8 vouchers, plus all of our little special programs. One of the things I think people don't realize is that housing authorities have so many different funding sources that it's really tough to keep up with each set of rules. But we do have a nonprofit that I started. I started a nonprofit a couple of years ago. I established it to help us raise funds for our supportive services programs. And so I am responsible for that nonprofit. I also am responsible for the homeownership counseling program that we have that is growing by leaps and bounds because of course, foreclosures. We do a lot of foreclosure counseling, and we've just hired 3 new people for that program just in the last week. So we're growing, and one of the things that happens being a regional, the largest housing authority in the region, is we're often looked at to handle Western Slope issues. So being kind of in the middle of the state, we have a lot of the, we host a lot of the meetings of the Western, region housing authorities, and we've also worked the voucher program for Moffitt County when they were having some trouble. Rather than them lose their vouchers, we would travel back and forth between Moffitt County, and we help them, establish a program and be able to keep their vouchers. We're also hopefully going to be doing some foreclosure counseling in Garfield County over the next couple of months. They are really in need and do not have a foreclosure counselor. So we've worked out hopefully some arrangements there that will be able to help them. So while we do handle Grand Junction Our primary working area is Grand Junction and the urban growth boundary. We also have an agreement with Mesa County to handle all of Mesa County. So while we say Grand Junction Housing Authority, we're actually covering all of Mesa County and then some of the work that we do in some of the other counties.
Great. And my next question is, what are some of the unique daily challenges that you face? I understand one of the things you have to do is audits. Also talk a little bit about what that is all about.
I think some of the unique challenges really just come from the funding sources that we have. Like I said earlier, we have so many different funding sources, and some of our properties have multiple funding sources. So we could have a property that is a Section 8 multifamily property but also has CHAFA funds invested, and then CDBG funds and all of those things. And each of those pots of money have different requirements. So while HUD may have a certain requirement level where they say, you're required to do this, if we have an intermediary, a funding source such as CHAFA, who handles some of the HUD properties, then we're required to follow their rules as well. And sometimes those are way more restrictive. Which is why I really wanted some help on this whole smoke-free thing and taking our 2 large complexes smoke-free, because they have so many different funding sources. And I knew it was going to be much more complicated than I had the time to deal with. So a lot of the challenges, I think, are funding sources. And then you spoke of audits. With the funding source comes an audit. So every funding source has a yearly audit. So sometimes I feel like we're in a perpetual state of audit. I mean, we have constantly got auditors here. I mean, I have them here right now. Whether it's HUD, you know, CHAFA, Enterprise, some of our other funding sources, we constantly are being audited. Plus, we have to hire our own auditors, and we do an external audit that we hire auditors for, and we do that once a year, and that's a huge week-long process.
Is the audit just a financial audit, or is there more to it than just a financial audit?
Well, it depends on the audit. If we are getting audited, for example, this summer we were audited on our voucher management system. That was a HUD audit. They came in and looked at much more than just our financials. While that was a part of it, they also looked at how we counted up, you know, our units, how we utilized our units, what our utilization rate was, and those kinds of things. So it depends on the funding source. It varies. If we promise to do something, whether it is, you know, provide deposit assistance or provide case management, whatever it is that we say we are going to do with that pot of money, we can expect an audit over that exact promise.
Okay, great. So the next thing, let's talk a little bit about your role on NARO. In case people aren't aware, NARO, the Colorado chapter of NARO, is part of a national organization of the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials, which is a membership-driven organization whose purpose is to provide professional development, advocacy, and networking to public housing and community development agencies, as well as to other organizations, to basically enhance affordable living communities in Colorado. So tell us a little bit about your role on the board and, you know, some of the things that you or the board do.
Sure. Well, I started out, I got on this board a little differently than how most people go about it. I actually received an appointment to the national, a national committee by our NARO president. And so I actually serve on a national committee, the Member Services Committee, and by serving on that committee, I then was appointed to the Colorado NARO and the Mountain Plains NARO. So I am a board member for Mountain Plains and Colorado NARO. And we do a lot of different things right now. What we're working on is our conference. Our yearly conference is coming up in May. And I don't know, Pete, if you've talked to anybody about trying to get a session in there, but that might not be a bad idea.
Sure.
We might want to talk about that after, but
yeah.
We are working on that. So we do the annual conference. We also we do some legislative work. While we're not, you know, paying folks to go on the Hill and represent us, we do advocacy. So we reach out to our members and make them aware of legislation. For example, last year we had the 60, 61, and 101 legislation. We did a lot of education around that. So that's a big part of what we do. We also represent our member agencies by offering training. If they're looking for training for property managers, we can bring a trainer in for that kind of thing. And we have a training center, two of them in Colorado, one in Colorado Springs and one in Denver, actually in Lakewood.
And how often do you have those trainings?
The trainings vary. It depends on what members are looking for. I believe this week we're having one for property managers. So it just depends. And they're real specific trainings for specific job duties. There are so many requirements that come with HUD funding, you would be amazed. I mean, especially for those folks that have public housing, which we divested of ours, so we don't have public housing anymore. But for those folks that have public housing, the list of requirements that come with that money is insane. And
yeah.
So we do a lot of training around that because there are so many different requirements. So it just depends, Pete. I mean, we could have two trainings a month and then maybe not have one for 2 months.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you know where the May conference will be this year?
It is in Breckenridge.
Okay.
And I believe it's the 17th, 18th, and 19th.
Okay. And do you know what states are part of the Mountain Plains chapter?
Oh, boy, you're testing me here. Montana, South Dakota, North Dakota, Wyoming, Colorado, Utah. I think that's it.
Okay.
If I'm missing somebody, forgive me, but I think that's it.
Yeah, I don't know myself. And then I guess the last question before we open it up to anybody is, do you have any general recommendations for the other grantees that are working on smoke-free housing with other housing authorities here in Colorado?
Well, I tell you, I think that a big part of what we're doing is really reaching out to residents early. I started reaching out to our resident advisory board last year, letting them know we applied for the grant. I don't want there to be any secrets. I don't want them to be surprised, our residents to be surprised when we go forward with this. I don't think there's anybody that really doesn't know at any of our properties that we're working on this. So I think that is a huge part of just relationship building with your tenants. And then also just making sure that, you know, each individual investor, whatever funding source you've got, is aware of what you're doing. So they're not surprised as well. And, you know, if they come in and object at the last minute, they could actually shut it down. And, I mean, I don't think that would happen, but it could. So it's important to just make sure that everybody's aware of what you're doing. And the other thing that we've done is we included in our grant money for legal assistance through our attorney. And just I just really think it's important to make sure that everything you're doing is within the scope of the law and that your attorney is comfortable with it.
Okay. You know, I remember a couple of years ago when we had Chuck Schlow of the Boulder County Housing Authority, one of the other things he said that was really helpful is having other people help in the process of implementing the policy as well. And I remember when I first talked to you, you said that having this grant, you know, made a huge difference in terms of your decision to move forward as well.
That is true. We probably wouldn't be doing it if we hadn't received the grant, just because, you know, as a governmental entity, our funding is stretched just like the next guy. So I just don't have the staff to put the time in, and without this grant, we wouldn't be doing it. Not at this time, anyway.
Okay. All right, so now let's go ahead and open up the lines to anybody else who would have some questions. Please identify yourselves again. So anybody have any questions for Lori at this time?
This is John from Denver. I have a question.
Certainly.
Go for it. Lori, I am working with the Denver Housing Authority here, and I have been trying for quite a while just to get a sense of how they operate, a sense of how they go, something goes from an idea to a policy or a resolution. And I haven't been able to collect that information because the stuff I've gathered online is either out of date or isn't current or anything like that. So what would you suggest? What would you recommend? I'm just trying to figure out, how do you take an idea from a concept to an actual policy? What are their steps? What are what makes them excited? You know, all this stuff. And I was wondering if you had any idea.
Well, that's a good question, because each housing authority is set up differently. But let me give you an example of how our housing authority would go through policy phase. And I should have done this in the beginning, because I think this is part of what Pete probably wanted me to talk about. But when our housing authority decides on an idea, and we have several unique programs that other housing authorities don't have, just because my board and my director are really open to trying different things. But first of all, I would say if you're not talking, you got to be talking to the right people. So I don't know who at DHA you're talking to, but you've got to be talking to the right people. And I don't know if you've had any conversations with Ismail or Stella, but I would say those are two people that need to be on board, or this is going to go nowhere. I mean, if their director's not on board, he's the one who has to take it to their board. But
okay.
So it starts with a concept. Of course, we run it through our executive director. If she's comfortable with it, then I present to the board. And we have a board of 7 directors, commissioners, who are appointed by the city council. So they review everything. So before I could even make a change to my policy, I have to run it through 2 boards, actually. One through our resident advisory board. If they approve it, then it's taken to our actual board, who then makes the final approval. So, again, that's our process. I don't know what DHA's process is. It all depends on how you were structured in the very beginning. And but those are 2 people if I would be talking to. Have you had any conversations with them?
We, Ishmael, is that his name?
Yeah, Ishmael.
He has signed a letter of agreement or being on our leadership team, so he has been part of the conversation. And Stella, after going to 3 meetings, I met her last week, so she and I are scheduled to get together and actually talk.
Oh, good. Then I think you're making progress.
Okay.
Because those
All right, good.
Are people that I would want on board with that agency if I did anything.
Okay, good. That's good to
hear.
From
what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, there aren't too many times where, you know, once a housing authority goes to a board and makes a recommendation, there haven't been too many times where they've been turned down. Am I correct?
Not for us. I mean, for the most part, our board knows that we do due diligence and we make sure that everything is legal and everything is within the scope of what our financial responsibilities are. And so, no, not usually, but that's my board. Other boards are different.
Yeah. And from some of the other housing authorities I have worked with, they generally have a pretty good relationship with their boards, and, you know, there, you know, aren't too many content. I mean, there's questions that come up and changes that come up sometimes based on their comments, but, you know, usually those recommendations go through, but, you know, it's not a perfect world. Are there any other questions?
Where is he, her contemporary?
Lori, this is Jill Bednarik at the State Health Department. I have some questions about, for like in John's case and in other counties or with other housing authorities, what kind of, what information, what information prompted you to consider this as an important issue, even before applying for funding?
Well, there were 2 things. First of all, our office used to be located at one of the properties, and for many years we thought, geez, you know, it really, you know, it smells like smoke in here. I don't know how people are handling it. And we didn't, back then we didn't get a ton of complaints. We as staff noticed it, but residents weren't complaining at all. Over the past 4 years or so, I think that things are changing. I think communities are starting to realize how important it is to have clean air. And so, again, our tenants are too. So over the last 4 years, we started to get a lot of complaints. And if you walk through the halls of our building, you can smell the smoke. And if I lived there, I wouldn't want to smell that if I was not a smoker. I just wouldn't. So we've been wanting to do this for a long time. And we've had a lot of reasonable accommodations around the smoke. We've had maintenance guys in trying to, you know, reinforce our insulation and that kind of thing, just to try to help people not have to deal with it. And we finally got to the point where we started looking at how expensive it was to turn units over that had long-time smokers in them. We just turned one over, and just the painting, we had to paint the unit 4 times. Once with kills, and it still didn't do the job. It was so bad. Even after the walls were washed and all of that, it was just crazy the amount of time my maintenance guys had to spend. We had to replace the carpet. And so all of those things kind of added to our decision. Plus, I think there's starting to be some movement within HUD. You guys have probably all seen the HUD notice that is encouraging us to take our building smoke-free. My experience with HUD is they usually start encouraging and then eventually require. So I would rather be ahead of the game. Not only is it probably the right thing to do, I mean, I know we're going to have some tenants that aren't going to think that, but we feel like it's the right thing to do, and it's also probably going to be required eventually. So that was our thinking. Hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, that does. That's great. Thank you.
Sorry. Great question. I think you're right, Laurie. That's what we're hearing as well. There are rumors that eventually this may be a mandate in public housing. We don't know about Section 8. That may take a little bit longer. Any other questions? All right.
Laurie, since there's not another question, I'll go ahead. This is Jill again. You talk about informing, needing our help, or the folks that are working on the grants help in educating the other funders. What kind of messages should we, do you think would appeal to them or would speak to their needs?
Boy, that's a good question. You know, we haven't gotten that far yet to where we've contacted all of our funders. I don't think there'll be a problem. There are so many different funding sources out there that different housing authorities have different relationships with their funders. I think the people we have will be open to this. I mean, they also know what's going on at HUD. So they've also received the notices. So they know that there's a push. But I think they could also get the complaint calls from the tenants. So if you're doing something and they don't know about it, they're really going to be mad when they get that first call. But I think you really just have to make your case. I mean, anytime you have somebody who is providing financial assistance to you or is a partner in, you know, anything that you do, they want to see you save money. And what I've done with everything that I do is I try to this is everything. This isn't just this issue, but everything that we do is try to show the financial advantage for doing something. And you cannot tell me that there is not a financial advantage to taking in it smoke-free. I mean, not only do we have less reasonable accommodations where we're spending a lot of time in units, reasonable accommodations where people want to move and we have to give them a voucher, and the cost of turnovers. I think if you can make the case that this is the right thing to do, not only, you know, for the tenants that don't smoke, but also financially, I can't see them not getting on board.
Yeah, and that's certainly one of our talking points, the financial aspect, as well as some of the other aspects of the benefits, fire, danger, safety, those are all important issues.
So what I heard you say, Laurie, in both the answer for what was a motivator for you and for what you think would motivate funders, and it may not be the same order, but it's basically the HUD notice, it's the cost of turnovers or the cost associated from a business sense with smoking, and then it's the complaints of the residents.
Yep, that sums it up.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome.
Just want to mention too. It doesn't surprise me that Laurie mentions that this started 4 years ago. That would be right after the Clean Indoor Air Act passed, and seeing that trend in Colorado for a number of years now. That once that law passed, and people are finding that they're not getting exposed to smoke in other places, they're noticing it much more in their residences. And that's always been the case when we've passed strong local ordinances as well, that, once we pass those, we'd get a lot more complaints about people being exposed to secondhand smoke in their apartments. All right, so are there any other questions? If not, we'll spend a few more minutes. If you have any other issues that you'd like to share or discuss with other grantees. Any other questions for Laurie?
Thanks, Pete. I'm going to sign off. I have to get something ready for another meeting. So
I bet you do. I thank you so much for your time. I know that You're a very busy person, and I really appreciate your taking the time to be with us today.
Lori. Oh, sure, yeah.
Sorry, this is John. Couldn't get off the mute. I do have one question, though, one last one. We're hearing that the Denver Housing Authority here is not having a lot of movement, meaning tenants aren't moving out due to, not being able to find another place that they're staying. Is that your experience, and does that hurt our efforts by having not a lot of movement?
Now, we're in a different situation here in Mesa County. Our vacancy rate is actually up. I mean, at one point, about a year and a half ago, we were at about 1% vacancy rate. At that point, no one was moving because there was nowhere for them to go. Right now, we have a lot of vacant units, and rents are starting to fall slowly, so people are able to move. So for us, that isn't such a problem, but I do know I've talked to Fort Collins and some other housing authorities, and their turnover rate is so small, and they don't have people moving as much as we do, but they also have, you know, less vacancy, and, you know, it could be that their policies don't allow much movement. You know, some people's policies only allow people to move once a year, you know, or only at lease renewal time. So there's a lot of things that can keep people where they're at. I don't know how their policy works. But for us, what we think is going to be successful is being able to offer our smokers who don't want to quit and who don't want to comply a voucher to move. Thing you've got to remember with our housing authority, too, is we have a pretty high turnover in our voucher program. So at any given time, we can have 15 vouchers turnover in any month. So us being able to offer a voucher is pretty easy. Other housing authorities like Denver, Fort Collins, their turnover rate is much lower. And I'm not sure what the difference is. I don't know why ours is higher. But so that very well could be an issue for them, depending on how you're structuring your, you know, turning their unit smoke-free, the policy that you're using. It depends on their turnover rate, and it sounds like theirs is low, and that doesn't surprise me. Did that answer your question?
Yes, it did. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Hey, Lori, before you leave us, Pete, when we were talking, Wendy mentioned something about a concern that you relayed to me. Wendy wasn't on the line with us, but about not being, you can't ask a tenant to move because they're a smoker?
You can't require them.
You can't.
You can offer it, but one of the HUD multi-unit housing notice said that, you know, there were several musts and several must-nots, and one of the must-nots is that you cannot require a residence to move. Now, there is some question as to, and I did talk to Jim Bergman about this as well just the other day, because I had that same question, is these are, you know, as Lori mentioned, these notices are generally, you know, suggestive,
mm-hmm.
and they're not necessarily a mandate, but there are things in it that say you do this and you must not do this, and the other day when we met with the Denver Housing Authority, they said that, well, there's usually, you know, there's a gray line there, you know, that they usually if there's a must in it, they, you know, usually try to comply with that.
So by, in our policy, by saying that it's a lease violation if they're caught smoking, basically we need to be cautious not to make statements like if you're found in violation of this, you'll be required to move. We could never say that in our policy.
I would think so. I would consult
this
with
Wendy.
Wendy.
I'm sorry, I hit mute and lost you.
Okay. I mean, you can talk to other housing authorities. I mean, yours is, I'm trying to remember, do you have Section 8 housing? I can't remember.
Yeah, Section 8 multifamily. We do not have public housing.
So, I know that some other housing authorities also, you know, they have, instituted, they do have fines, you know, that, you know, for cleanup. But from what I've heard, those fines are very hard to actually collect from somebody who's very low income. So. Wendy, do you have anything to say?
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, the synopsis that I just caught was correct. You can't require people to leave. However, it is very dependent upon the individual housing authority. And what I've actually been doing is looking at the policies for each housing authority. So it does depend on the housing authority, but sort of the bottom line picture is that you can't kick somebody out who is eligible to, who qualifies otherwise to be in housing authorities, Section 8 housing, public housing, those types of things. So what I'm doing is looking at things on an individual basis for each of the grantees so that we can be sure that we have the right policy in place. The other thing that we want to remember is that when you're implementing a new policy and making changes, it's very important to be sure that you provide legally sufficient notice for changes in smoking policies. So that's something that's important as well. It's not to say that you can't change the policies, but you do need to give sufficient notice to current residents. And did I probably missed some other things because I was off trying to dial back in.
Okay. Go ahead, Ivy.
I was just going to say that Lori and I are meeting with our attorney today with our policy, and after we've met with the attorney here and have the policy a little bit better drafted at that point, then, Wendy, I was going to send it your way as well to make
wonderful,
sure.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And I think our suggestion around vouchers, and sometimes people want a voucher anyway. I mean, they're more appealing. They can choose where they want to live.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I think we can easily make the case to folks that, you know, this is a good thing for you. You know, you can get a place with a balcony, you can get a place with a patio, with a backyard, whatever.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
It's just, you just don't want to go to the level of moving the option for somebody that doesn't have any other options. But you are correct, yes.
Well, and frankly, as a housing authority, our job is to house, not to throw people on the street. So that is so not something we would ever allow to happen,
right.
And our board wouldn't allow that to happen.
Exactly, yeah.
Plus, I just met Maxine this last week when I was posting my surveys on the doors, and Maxine is 80 and has been smoking for 60 years, and
uh-huh.
She was a delight. I love her.
Oh.
And we have more than one Maxine type here in Grand Junction and as residents. So, you know, it's definitely a passionate issue.
Sure, yeah.
Lori, am I correct from what I've heard from talking to some other housing authorities is that, you know, these HUD notices are treated as recommendations? One of them told me that they get these all the time, and sometimes they end up, you know, on a pile of papers, and they're not taken as seriously until they are mandated.
Well, actually, it depends on the notice. If you've got, sometimes it's called guidance. If you've got guidance attached to a notice, then your guidance is a regulation, and you have to do it. But if the notice says may or we recommend, then of course you don't have to. But you do have to be really careful with notices because there many of those notices are required. A notice is actually oftentimes, you know, there's a notice and then there's time for public comment, and then the final notice comes out, which is the final rule.
And I think, too, the point that Lori raised is I think that this is the trend of where things are going, and so I think that this is laying the foundation for it to be a requirement in the notices that have recently come out.
Yeah, I don't see HUD doing recommendations like this often if they're not going to, you know, start requiring it. I mean, there was a lot of stuff around student rule many years ago. I mean, it started several years before that rule became final.
Yeah, and this notice is actually quite specific compared to some other notices that I have.
It was.
It has a lot of musts and must nots. And some of those musts are, if I remember correctly, are in the HUD handbook anyways.
That right.
People have to follow anyways.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right. Anybody else want to talk about anything else that's going on this week? I'm going to go ahead and leave the recording going and And that way we have a record of the entire call, should anybody want to listen to it.
Well, thanks
anybody
for having
else want?
I'm going to let you guys go.
Again, thank you again.
If you have
thanks,
any questions,
Lori.
Feel free to email me or call me.
Thanks so much, Lori.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
So anybody want to talk about what they're doing this week and any other issues they're been confronting?
Well, this is Ivy in Grand Junction, and I know that our executive director was saying that one of the things that could be a good selling point for the Grand Junction Housing Authority Board is determinations or decisions made by the Mental Health Center of Denver and the fact that they were choosing to go smoke-free. If we knew why that was happening, if we had some talking points from that specific arena, that it would be a good selling point for our board. So I don't know if John Young has anything or somebody would have input for me on that.
Ivy, this is Wendy again.
Yes.
I'm actually working with Mandy May and Chad Morris on their particular grant, so I'm happy in my meeting with Mandy, which is coming up soon, to pose that to them and see if we can't get some more information to you, if that helps.
That would be so beautiful because
okay.
Mandy was one that Tara had given me Mandy's name as a person of contact, and I just haven't had opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
But from your end, if you were able to get some information, that would be amazingly wonderful for me.
Sure, I'll do that because I'm meeting with Mandy anyway, so that's not a problem at all.
Great. Thank you.
Is Karen Devine still? I'm sorry. Is Karen Devine still on the call?
I am still on the call, and I will pass along the message to Mandy as well.
Yeah, I already mentioned it to Mandy as well, and I did provide Ivy with her contact information. So
great,
hey,
thank you all. Thank you.
And this is John in Denver.
Uh-huh.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is John in Denver. I'm on the leadership team for them, so you know if you want to. Ask me anything. I'm always free over lunch, especially if you're buying.
It's a long drive for me to buy, but I'll think about it.
Thanks.
Anybody else have anything you want to discuss or have any concerns going on this week? How's your getting anywhere with your survey, John?
I'm still waiting to get pieces and parts back from Denver Housing Authority because, as you know, they said they would take it, look it over, make some adjustments, create some new questions, and send that to me so that we would have a new document. And as of right now, I haven't gotten anything back from them, so I'm pretty sure I'm going to have to kind of light a fire underneath them. But I'm also working on the key informant questions and that sort of thing. And at our next meeting with the Housing Authority, I'm going to bring in our facilitators so they can actually get some concrete dates to set stuff up so that they can get on the calendar for doing focus groups and that sort of thing. So we've got stuff in the works, and it just depends on when they get back to us. And as you know, we want them to work with us, so I can't be pushing them. I can just call and make suggestions.
Right. Anybody else? Anything you want to share or any concerns?
I'll just say that I already have a 52% return rate on the survey that I posted. There were 78 units involved, so I'm getting good input from the one property already. So that's good news.
That's great.
Great. And have you done anything in terms of inputting the data, or are you just waiting to get everybody's back?
You know, I have done some preliminary. I'm caught up with putting stuff in, but I couldn't give you any summary at this point. I'm trying not to weigh too much on that right now.
Yeah,
Ivy,
Johnny. Sorry,
I have a
go ahead.
I have a question for Ivy. This is Karen. Are you just posting them on the door, and then how are they returning them, and are you offering incentive to return them?
I didn't offer an incentive. I did hand post them. There were about 185 units total that I needed to post, so I just did them by hand. And so no incentives, but the convenience of returning them, they just need to put them in their rent collection box at the manager's office. So it was a fairly simple turnaround point for them, at the property. And I have had, and then of course, right on the survey, it's got my information for contact for assistance if they need it. And I have had, probably 6 phone calls, but 3 of those were from the same person. So I didn't provide incentives. I suppose if you had more properties or other situations that were less convenient, then maybe you'd want to offer an incentive, but I didn't do that on this one.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And you, if I remember correctly, you didn't ask people to identify themselves on the poll, right? It was anonymous, right?
Correct. I asked them not to. Yes.
This is Jill, and I just thought of this clear back from graduate school. I thought one of the best ideas I'd ever seen for incentives was a tea bag. Make yourself a cup of tea while you do this survey. It's going to take about that much time, and enjoy a quiet moment, basically. And it's really inexpensive. It's the price of a tea bag, and it's a nice gesture to your folks to do while they complete the survey.
I love that. I wish I would have thought of it. That's great.
What if they don't drink tea?
Then go get one of those new Starbucks instant little, you pour it in some hot water and you've got a Starbucks cup of coffee.
Yeah, maybe one of each. Little instant coffee and a little tea bag at the same time.
Perfect.
Anybody else?
Yep, this is Karen from University of Colorado Denver. I just can give you an update. So we finished all of our tours of a big chunk of the facilities within MHCD. We have a whole list of recommendations on how to get them smoke-free to all their facilities, including their 2 apartment buildings. And Chad and Mandy are meeting with Cheryl Clark right now, and we'll see how she feels about all the recommendations we made. But I'm sure Mandy can share that with you too, Pete, and whoever else.
Right.
Interested? Yeah.
Yeah, and basically, for those of you who may not know, their indoor units are already smoke free, and they do allow smoking outside. And what they're trying to do now is make the entire property smoke free. Karen, are you aware of some of the recommendations?
Oh, yeah, no, I've been working with Mandy really closely on this. Well, it's sort of twofold because, one, we really want to push them to strengthen their current tobacco smoke-free policy. From our tours and from a case study that we did that was actually under a previous grant, they're having some challenges with monitoring and with adherence. And so one of our key recommendations is to really re-educate and educate the providers and consumers on the policy and the importance of just being smoke-free. It's sort of a tobacco 101 class for everyone. And then for the residential facilities, we have a variety of recommendations that – hopefully they'll consider. One of them that we're really pushing is just to not even allow smoking. A lot of the resolution for the sites is, okay, well, you can't smoke on our property, so just go stand in the street or in the mm-hmm. alley. And so those are safety issues, especially for our patients. So we're really want to encourage them to not allow it anywhere on or near the property, and to help them find ways to help people refrain while they're at the residential facilities. So those are the two biggest hurdles we're going to have to overcome with MHCD.
Yeah, and if I remember right, when speaking to Mandy, the other rationale was neighbor complaints of people smoking near their homes, too.
Absolutely, so yeah. The neighbors, there's already some tension there, you know, because bringing in a mental health housing facility into the neighborhood creates tensions, which is a shame. So then the residents go out and they smoke in the street or they smoke in the alley, and, it just gives the neighbors another reason to complain. And so one of the things that we're also recommending is, of course, notification and starting that immediately, and then notification to the neighbors. You know, drop into a neighborhood watch meeting, or even host like an open house. And it's really important. We learned through other sites that we've helped go tobacco-free. The sooner you can start telling your neighbors, the sooner you can start telling neighboring businesses and the residents, it makes the process easier.
Great. How about Karen and Delta? Anything you want to share?
Sorry about that. Yeah. I am waiting to hear about our mini grant because we would like to involve our students from the Delta Opportunity School to do the resident surveys. So we had put in a mini grant, and if Judy or Jill is on the line, I wonder if you could maybe give us a time frame on when we might hear back on that.
Judy, are you there? I'm not sure about the time frame. Tara, are you still there?
Yeah, this is Judy. Sorry, got to unmute. At this point in time, the contracting coordinator is working on the paperwork, and so I'm keeping my fingers crossed of having everything completed by the end of the month, but of course I can't promise that. We need to have it go over to our procurement side as well for final approval, but at any cost, and then of course it goes before the Board of Health today for their approval, and so the contract would be pending Board of Health approval, and then getting everything signed on our end, and then the paperwork will be sent back to the contractor. It'll be a purchase order, and that will be it. But for right now, that's where it stands, is that it's in the hands of the contracting coordinator.
Okay, thanks.
All right. Does anybody else have anything to share? All right. Well, thank you for participating in the call. And just want to let you know, if you don't already know, next month on the 16th, we'll have a special guest, Tina Pettengill, who's been working on smoke-free housing way before I started, and recently has done quite a few tenant presentations, and has recently done some presentations with some difficult tenants at the Portland, Maine Housing Authority, and she'll talk to us a little bit, share with us her presentation, and talk to us a little bit about the messaging she uses and some of the issues that how well that works. So thank you, and we'll talk again.
Thanks, Pete.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please stand by.